What is your take on the recent Billy Carson, Wes Huff debate?
I go to ancient texts for reasons very different to Wes Huff. I am interested in the Gnostic literature because I want to know what did the first Christians believe. I am interested in texts that didn't make it into the canon because I want to know, well, what was the earliest Christian view? And I say that having been a zealous apologist in the past.
God is not supposed to be singular in the Bible. It's plural in all cases, gods with an S.
So Billy continues on his quest to prove to anyone who actually understands the biblical languages that he doesn't understand them. The word Elohim is what's known as a concretized abstract plural. And this is a function within the Hebrew language where a plural word is used in a singular sense. And a concretized abstract plural operates in a similar way to, say, the English word sheep. So we can have one sheep or 50 sheep.
The word Elohim is not like the word sheep that is the same in the singular as it is in the plural. Elohim, you go to the roots of the word, means the powerful ones. The Elohim exhibit plural behaviors. They go to war against each other. They have conversations among one another. They have different agendas for humanity. The Elohim say, let us make the humans to look like us. The Elohim say, we don't want the humans to be too much like one of us. In Genesis 11, you've got the Elohim saying, let us go down and confuse their languages. Where it gets confusing is that a later writer who knows the holy name of Yahweh has imported that name into earlier Elohim texts. There is no question that Elohim is in the plural, and that the Elohim plural stories parallel the Anunnaki plural stories. Before we get into today's content, on behalf of the Fifth Kind TV, I want to say a big thank you to Surfshark for sponsoring today's content. Surfshark is a VPN that allows us all to become citizens of the world through online access. If you're like me, you'll enjoy watching online content from countries all around the world. But I live in Australia, and what I'm shown in internet searches will be different to what you're shown in Canada, America, the Philippines, Germany, the Netherlands, or wherever you're watching from. By using Surfshark, I'm able to access a world of online content and see all the things that you see and many other things beside. Surfshark enables us to become citizens of the world through online availability.
Get fully protected. Go to surfshark.com/fifthkind and get 4 months for free. Surfshark offers a 30-day money-back guarantee, so if you try it and you don't like it, you can easily cancel your subscription and receive a full refund. With Surfshark, you can swim under the radar in the sea of online content.
How do the Elohim influence us today? Does your research provide any clues to what happened to the Elohim of ancient times?
Thanks, Chris. That's a great question. It's actually the central question of my book, The Eden Conspiracy, which follows the Yahweh storyline in the Hebrew scriptures. And it shows that there's a period in the Hebrew story where the Elohim, the powerful ones, are governing human populations much in the way that we do when we invade each other's countries. And we go in with force, we go in with our armies, we overwhelm the local resistance, and then we run everything. And the display of our the visible display of our force is how we maintain order. And the Elohim stories and Yahweh stories are somewhat like that. And then there comes a point in 1 Samuel 8 where the tribes of Israel no longer want to be governed in that way, and they get rid of direct rule by Yahweh. They say, we now want human kings for human society, and they think they've sacked him. But in fact, as the story rolls on, it shows that Yahweh is still pulling strings from behind closed doors. And it really is a story that stands as a model of the persistence of old powers and the presence of hidden hands in politics and economics. It's almost like a prototype of what's happened in Great Britain, for instance, as Great Britain has tried to move towards democracy, and yet it still has the monarchy in place with tremendous constitutional power. And so if I go to the Yahweh story, it looks like a story in which the old powers do persist, but not so visibly. And again, we could liken it to what happens when we invade each other's countries. And once we set the commodity prices and the exchange rates and set up the legal frameworks for everything, we can go home and still benefit from sitting at the top of the economic and political tree. And I see the arrival of the Tzeva Hashamayim, the sky armies, and then the departure of the Elohim, the departure of Yahweh, in terms similar to that. And I argue in the Eden conspiracy that it's not hard to see that patterns that were set up in the deep past have persisted very happily through the ages, that it's not hard to point to Elohistic influences in the way we order society, or Yahwist influences even in geopolitics today. So I probably don't need to go into much further detail than that, than to say, I think the evidence of our past colonization is still very real, still very much in place. We don't have face-to-face contact with Elohim and Yahweh in the present, but I think the aftermath of that period of colonization is easy to see.
Please clarify the difference between Anunnaki, the Watchers, and Elohim. Are they one and the same? Thanks from Debbie.
Thanks, Debbie. Well, in my Eden series, I argue that the Elohim of the Hebrew scriptures, that's really the Bible's way of speaking about the Anunnaki. And the dependence of the biblical stories on the Mesopotamian stories of Anunna, Anunnaki, is something that's been known since the 1870s, when Assyriologist George Smith first wrote about it with his book, The Chaldean Account of Genesis. And within that dependence, there are some close equivalences. So we can see Yahweh taking on the role of Enlil at certain points. We can find Asherah in the Hebrew stories taking on the role of Ashari in the Mesopotamian telling. We've got Noah is taking on the role of Zusudra, Atrahasis, Utnapishtim, etc. And there are conversations that Yahweh has in his own mind that are really a rolling together of conversations among the Anunnaki, among Enlil, Enki, Ninhursa, etc. So the word Anunnaki, the Babylonian word, is a pretty wide catch-all kind of word, as we might translate it as astronauts. These are people who've come from another world, from the heavens, from the skies, and have arrived and are now governing Project Earth. And so there can be various kinds of being captured by that word Anunnaki, just as there are various kinds of being captured by the word Elohim. So in 1 Kings 22, if you go to the Sky Council that was remote viewed by the prophet Micaiah, we can see that on the Bardat, on the council, are various kinds of Elohim in conversation about how to manage Project Earth. And we even have an extra term in the Hebrew telling, the Bene Elohim, which I argue means Elohim kind, the class of Elohim, the ones like the Elohim. And again, there's a spectrum of kinds of being. And within that spectrum, we have the Igiji in the Sumerian telling, the observers, the watchers. So they take on the role of observers in the Mesopotamian telling, and then they come for some shore leave, and there's some controversy that arises from that, and we get into a hybridization story. That story is told in Genesis 6. Genesis 6 is a summary of form of what's in the Book of Enoch, and the Book of Enoch uses this phrase, the watchers, to describe those who come and breach some fundamental arrangement that's been agreed, and we get into a hybridization story. So I argue in the Eden Conspiracy that the Watchers of Enoch are the observers of the Enuma Elish, are the observers of the Mesopotamian story. And they are just one group within this wider group of Elohim, which simply means the powerful ones, all kinds of powerful ones, and within this wider group of Anunnaki, these demographics that came from the heavens to the earth. And I wouldn't say interfered in the human story, because they did incredibly important and creative things in the human story as well. But it was certainly a spectrum of experience reported in those narratives.
I understand that you still consider yourself a follower of Christ. Are there any other religions that fit your current belief system? Would you consider starting one, or are you totally against religions?
Thanks, Jasper. No, I don't think I'd want to start a religion, really. I think I've managed organizations in the past, and I'm very happy to be not managing an organization right now and doing the research work that I am doing. No, I'm not completely against religions. I found that in all kinds of religion all around the world, you can find seekers of truth. You can find incredibly profound writings of wisdom and human understanding. And in my own experience of Christianity, when I study church history, phenomenal things have come out of the hodgepodge of Christianity, all kinds of social reforms, all kinds of scientific endeavor. Where I have a problem with religion is that if it trades on separation anxiety, the idea that you or I are separated from God, we need the priests or the teachers to tell us how to claw our way back into God's good books. If that's the belief system, then you are dependent on an institution and you've given power to an institution that is very, very corrupting. And you set yourself up for all kinds of abuses and manipulations. And I think we can see that in every religion. The politics of most religions can get pretty unpleasant and pretty ugly. So for that reason, I am nervous of institutional expressions of religion. I still call myself a Christian because I have a belief in God, and I've been a follower of the teachings of Jesus for 43 years. By my definition, that would make me a Christian. There may be plenty of others who don't give me that label, because I don't hold to all the mainstream dogmas, and I talk about things that are taboo and that are off script. But for my money, I would call myself a Christian. What's been interesting for me in my journey of research is to realize that when in the past I saw really hard boundaries in between different religions, is this belief system, and it doesn't cross over with this one, it doesn't cross over with this one. My view has changed over the years, firstly, because I find that mystics writing from any religious tradition often find they're talking about very similar experiences and approaches to reality. And also because when I get into the full spectrum, the kaleidoscope of early Christianity, I realized there was a whole lot more overlap with Eastern thought than ever I realized as a young Christian. When I read Plato, I hear things that sound very redolent of Buddhism. So the idea that we exist as beings of consciousness before incarnating in this material life, that we're here to learn things and have experiences, and then after a life review, we go on to the next thing, which might be a completely different kind of experience, or we might go around another time. I hear that in Plato, and I think, well, that sounds rather like Buddhism. When I hear Plato saying that one of the chief learnings that we have to make in this life is how to shake off heavier emotions, this was the word he used for it, so that we're not operating in rage or fury or unforgiveness or terror or trauma or anxiety, and that if we can shake those off and operate in higher emotions like love and compassion and curiosity, that we'll have a better human experience. And we will transition better to the next thing. Again, when Plato says that, I think this is sounding very much like Buddhism. And now I realize that many of the early church fathers were 110% invested in Platonic thought. And there are clues of their investment in Plato all through the New Testament. And again, whereas in the past, I thought, well, there's Greek thought here, there's pagan thought here, there's Judaic thought here, and then there's Christian thought here. Now I realize that the early writers of Christianity lived and breathed Plato, and that there are appeals to Platonic ideas in the scriptures themselves. So in the prologue to the Gospel of John, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. He was with God in the beginning. Then the Word became flesh. And then he has this material experience. And then at the end of the Gospel, he's saying, and now, Father, I'm going to return to you back to the glory we enjoyed together before the foundation of the world. That's a Platonic story arc for all of us. And there are other moments like that that tell me, no, Christianity was drinking at a deep well, and the writers knew, were scholars of international thought. And you can hear the notes of it in early Christian writings. So I don't see this clear blue water between Christianity and Buddhism, for instance, that I saw in the past. And I now go back to religious texts with a different eye. Instead of going back wanting to argue for orthodoxy and argue against everything else that contradicts it, I go back because I'm looking for wisdom. And I find it very interesting when the wisdom being offered by one tradition overlaps with the wisdom offered by another. I find that compelling.
Paul, I follow your and Mauro Biglino's work very closely. I'm writing a book titled Yahweh, a Levantine Warlord. I want to address the strongest arguments that apologists and theologians make to debunk your work. Where can I find strong academic and biblically based arguments that oppose you and Mauro? I keep searching, but nearly all I find is praise for your work. Is the church scared of discussing or debating you, or have they somewhere, that I haven't seen, dismissed you and Mauro as nutters and or liars? I really hope you answer this question, and I'll send a draft of my book in 4 weeks' time if you want. It'll be about 20,000 words. Cheers.
Hi, Peter. I think if you want to find academic writers supporting what I'm saying, what Mauro is saying, probably the best places you can go to are to Hebrew universities and to departments of Assyriology and departments of archaeology. And there, I think you'll find some very robust conversation about who Yahweh was, where he fits in the ancient pantheon, whether he had evolved from a Canaanite god of war and then morphed into this almighty god in the Hebrew vision. If you go into the world of archaeology, then I find that very interesting. So William Deaver put out some really interesting material about the actual place of Yahweh in ancient Jewish practice, and realizing that he is one entity alongside others. There was a really interesting archaeological find just last year, actually, in 2024, the seal of Yehoezer, which I talk about in my book, The Eden Enigma, which gives us a little window onto what Judaism was before it was monotheized. So before the 8th to 6th century reforms, that turned Judaism from what I would describe as a canon of paleocontact, or what academics might describe as polytheism. Those reforms took Judaism from that, turned it into monotheism. But before they did that, Jewish people were still familiar with what the Elohim looked like. They saw them as part of the spectrum of the Anunnaki stories, and the seal of Yehoezer shows it, because it's the seal of a senior Jewish figure used to solemnize his documents and authenticate his documents and seal letters. And what's the image on the seal? It's the image of a Tingir, of an Assyrian deity, as scholars might call it. He had no problem with that image. He had no problem with seeing his Jewish faith and his Jewish stories within the context of the Mesopotamian Anunnaki and Dinjir. So archaeology brings up some really interesting results as well. But when it comes to a response to my work from the churches, no, it's pretty thin pickings. I know that the churches are pressing forward in terms of equipping their clergy for what they call paranormal ministry. And what that usually means is entity removal, because a lot of pastors and parish priests find they have to get involved with that. And so every diocese, for instance, in the Church of England is supposed to have an expert to guide clergy in that work. But when those clergy are looking for a response to my work that's talking about other kinds of contact and evidence of contact in the Bible, then there is no response, not as yet. The closest to churches getting onto this territory, I think, has been achieved by the Roman Catholic Church. And so if you go to the writings of Reverend Dr. Guy Consolmagno, who is a senior astronomer for the Vatican Observatory, or to statements and interviews with Father Jose Gabriel Funes of the Vatican Observatory, or read papers by Monsignor Corrado Balducci, who was the Vatican's senior advisor in paranormal ministry, there you will hear very eminent scholars talking about the credibility of ET contact being present in the Bible, in the Hebrew scriptures, and in the New Testament. So they've been bolder in going there. I think also, if you go to a Bible like the New Jerusalem Bible and get an expanded study edition and read the footnotes, that's where you'll see some acknowledgement of the Bible's dependence on Mesopotamian sources. And as you read those footnotes, the question will form, sorry, who are these Elohim? Who are these powerful ones? Who are these Anunnaki on which they're based? And it throws up the questions that I wrestle with in my books. But if you're looking for an academic rebuttal of my work or Mauro's, it really has not yet happened.
What is your take on the recent Billy Carson, Wes Huff debate?
Well, it was a very frustrating debate to watch. There were a number of subjects I would have loved to have heard discussed in that conversation, and the conversation sort of moved towards these topics and then never dealt with them. And I don't want to be personal about it, but I was frustrated with the moderation of it, that really interesting topics got brought up and then somehow got tripped over each time, and we never got onto the real topic. So, for instance, I would have been really interested to have heard a conversation between Billy and Wes about the idea that Jesus may have had a girlfriend or even a wife. But the conversation tripped up over the question of the Karen King fragment. Now, the Karen King fragment is a really interesting fragment of literature from the 300s. This is in the Gnostic period, and it's a text that refers to Jesus's wife. But unfortunately, when Billy raised the question of the fragment, initially Wes said he didn't know what texts Billy was talking about. And then once Billy repeated, "I do mean that what's called the Gospel of Jesus's wife, this fragment found by Karen King," Wes's response is, "Oh, that's been debunked." And so we never got onto the discussion. But the fact is, it has not been debunked. This is a fragment that was studied by Karen King, one of the world's leading experts in Gnostic sources. Karen King of Harvard University had analyzed this text and then submitted it to the Harvard Theological Review for them to examine and assess. And their conclusion is that there was no evidence that this was a modern forgery at all. Now, there was still pushback. The Vatican immediately pushed back and said, "Oh, this can't be right. But they didn't have the fragment. They hadn't done the work. They were pushing back against the idea of it, which I find very strange, because the fragment only goes a fraction of an inch further than other sources that we have, Pistis Sophia, the Gospel of Philip, the Gospel of Mary Magdalene. All those sources suggest Jesus had this close relationship with Mary Magdalene, and that it somewhat offsided some of the other apostles. There was this bit of conflict between Peter and Mary Magdalene, and the fragment only goes half an inch further than the Gospel of Philip, which tells us that Jesus would kiss Mary Magdalene frequently on the lips or on the mouth. But the word wife is what's used in this fragment, which is what put the wind up everybody, why there was this pushback. But it was not debunked. The Harvard Theological Review has not retracted its statement that there's no evidence of fakery or forgery. What has been found is that the fragment we have is probably later than the original, because there are conventions of writing used in the fragment that are not ancient. And there's been some dependence suggested on the Gospel of Thomas, but that doesn't falsify it. The Gospels of Matthew and Luke are dependent on Mark. It doesn't falsify those documents. So the fragment is still very much in play and has been for the last decade. So it's not true that it was debunked. So it tripped up on that question. So we never had the conversation of why does it matter? And what does it mean that there were communities of faith in early Christianity that had no problem with the idea that Jesus may have been in a relationship and may have been married? Why does Orthodoxy have such a big problem with it? And why was it the stories that had Jesus as unique and single and unattached that became Orthodoxy, and questions of a relationship became taboo? I would have loved to have heard that conversation, but we never got onto that because it got tripped up. And then another moment the conversation tripped up was Billy referred to the Sinai Bible. And at first, Wes said, well, I don't know what you mean by the Sinai Bible. Well, what Billy meant is what is generally meant by the Sinai Bible, which is the Codex Sinaiticus. But what Billy had not remembered and was trying to remember, and I do accept Billy was very ill on the evening of that. He was not on form at all. You've only got to watch to see he was still very sick with pneumonia, and he just wasn't on top of this source, and he couldn't quite remember where he was going. But where he was going is that in the Codex Sinaiticus, which is one of the earliest entire New Testament canons within a codex, within a book, we have an earlier version of the Gospel of Mark, and it's a version without resurrection appearances. And the reason that's interesting is that when we go to the earliest materials we have in the wider Christian canon, you've got that form of Mark, Q material shared by Luke and Matthew, and I would argue you've got the Gospel of Thomas as well. I would argue for an early date. And in none of those sources are there resurrection appearances. The reason this could be significant is that when we go to the earliest canonical writings for Christianity, the writings of Paul, the idea of resurrection in his writing is very different to the later writing of Matthew, Luke, and John, and later Orthodoxy. Later Orthodoxy is talking about a reanimated corpse that's been reanimated in a way that means it will survive forever. But that's not what the Apostle Paul talks about in 1 Corinthians 15. Again, it's much closer to the Platonic idea that when our material bodies die, we carry on as spiritual entities, or spiritual bodies is his language. And he talks about, you know, corruptible bodies die and decompose. We're raised something incorruptible. We're raised a spiritual entity. We're raised a spiritual body. It's much, much closer to the Platonic idea. And if that's Paul's idea of resurrection, Jesus's as well as ours, and if there are no physical bodily resurrection appearances in those earlier sources, it puts a big question mark over the later development, the later story. In the later story, the raised Jesus has a body that can eat food, cook a meal, you can touch the wounds. But this is written maybe a couple of generations after Paul is writing what he wrote in and around AD 65. And again, there's an absence of resurrection appearances. When the Apostle Paul talks about resurrection experiences, his own is not an encounter with a physical body. He has an encounter with light. He hears a voice. He experiences love and restoration. And he equates his experience with the appearances of Jesus to the 500, the apostles, to James, to Peter, to the 12. And so this is a really interesting conversation. What was the original understanding of the empty tomb? Is that a trope from Greco-Roman story to say he has now become divine? And is that really the punchline of the original Gospel of Mark? What was the meaning of these resurrection appearances? Were they a physical body, or were they subjective, spiritual experiences like the ones Paul had? Now, that's the conversation I would have loved to have heard between Billy and Wes, but again, it got tripped over because, unfortunately, Billy couldn't quite remember his source and where he was going in that moment. But I just wish that, I think Wes probably did know where Billy was going, and I wish the moderator had moved the conversation onto that topic, because there are these two separate strands of understanding in primitive Christianity. And the earlier one, I think, is far more open and far more interesting, and I might even suggest more credible than the later, more developed Orthodox view. So that's another place where I found it very frustrating. But I think, you know, if you're going to put an apologist alongside a writer of esoterica, you're going to have a frustrating conversation, because classically the work of an apologist is to show the reasonableness of faith. So someone like Justin Martyr, that was how he saw his role, to show that what Christians believed was reasonable, every bit as reasonable as what the Greeks and Romans believed. But I think people who call themselves apologists today very often fall into a dynamic in which they begin with their Orthodox faith, and then they see their role as finding evidence that supports that Orthodox view, and then they find ways to dismiss any evidence that argues against that Orthodox view. And so if you put an apologist alongside another kind of scholar or an esoteric writer, there's going to be a clash. I go to ancient texts for reasons very different to Wes Huff. I am interested in the Gnostic literature because I want to know, what did the first Christians believe? I am interested in texts that didn't make it into the canon because I want to know, well, what was the earliest Christian view? And I don't believe that Christianity stands or falls on being able to prove historic events. So it's just a totally different agenda. And it means that in the end, you always end up talking at cross purposes with an apologist. It's always going to be a frustrating conversation. And I say that having been a zealous apologist in the past. So I think for all those reasons, it really was a frustrating conversation. I wish the moderator had moved it onto the actual topics instead of continually tripping over this mismatch of agendas and then tripping over sources. I think Billy made some mistakes. I think Wes made some mistakes or was not up to date in his information on various sources. And it could have been a better conversation if we'd discussed things like the ones I've mentioned. That's my view.
Some argue that the word Elohim, despite its plural form, functions as a concretized abstract plural in Hebrew, similar to how the English word sheep can be singular or plural, depending on context. Can this interpretation account for the complexities around Elohim in the Hebrew Bible?
Thank you, TechWiz. That is a great question and a really key question. The short answer is no. That is not an explanation. The word Elohim is not like the word sheep, that is the same in the singular as it is in the plural. Elohim, you go to the roots of the word, means the powerful ones. And there are singular forms of that word. You can use the word El. You can use the word Elohe. Elohim is the masculine plural form. And one of the reasons you can't say it's become concretized and it can be used as a plural or single, and that's all there is to it, is that we see the behavior of the Elohim through the text. So we can see that the Elohim arrive in plural as the Tzeva Hashemayim, the airborne armies. We can see that they function as the Ba'adat, the council. The Elohim exhibit plural behaviors. They go to war against each other. They have conversations among one another. And they have different agendas for humanity. And all this plays out in the Elohim stories. If you go to Deuteronomy 32, you'll find El Elyon carving up the land and apportioning it to different Elohim. And the word used in the text is Bene Elohim. So this is the class of Elohim, the ones like the Elohim, Elohim kind, and the Elohim are each getting different lands. So another clue that it's not a word like sheep is that we can find it being used in the plural with plural behaviors and plural verb forms. So the Elohim say, let us make the humans to look like us. The Elohim say, we don't want the humans to be too much like one of us. We've got texts where, for instance, Abraham, there's a moment in Genesis 20 where Abraham is talking about the moment when the Elohim plural forced me, plural, to move. Plural form subject, plural form verb. And so you've got these plural behaviors, plural verb forms. It really is a case of if it looks like a duck and swims like a duck, it may be a duck that you're looking at. In Genesis 11, you've got the Elohim saying, let us go down and confuse their languages. And where it gets confusing is that a later writer who knows the holy name of Yahweh has imported that name into earlier Elohim texts. So he does it in plain sight. If you read the text, if you see Lord in all capitals, that's the word Yahweh. And it tells you that a writer after the time of Yahweh is retelling older stories. And so there are times when you'll see Yahweh Elohim and a plural verb form, and then other times with a single verb form. There's a moment when in the English, Elohim gets used in the singular. So we can find this in 2 Kings, for instance, where Yahweh is very angry with his king, who has broken his back, and he wants to know if he's going to get better, if he's going to survive. And he's heard that the Elohim of Ekron is very good at medical prognostics. So he sends some people off to get a prognosis from him. And according to the prophet Elijah, Yahweh is furious, and he says, is there no Elohim here, that Ahaziah has to go prancing off to the Elohe of Ekron? Except that the verb form isn't there. But the indication is that Elohim is being used in the singular in that moment. And there are some moments in the scriptures where it's not clear if we're looking at a plural or a singular. So if we go, for instance, to the text in Joshua 24, where Joshua is calling upon the people of Israel, and he says, choose today whom you'll serve. Will you serve the Elohim of Egypt or the Elohim of Mesopotamia, or will you serve Yahweh? And it's not clear if there are many Elohim in Mesopotamia or many Elohim in Egypt, or is he just referring to Achech in Egypt in the singular? But I think the behaviors make very clear there's a plurality. And if you go to the Ten Commandments, for instance, there is that moment in the Ten Commandments where Yahweh says, you must have no other Elohim before me. Do not bow down to them. Do not even depict them. Do not work for them in the plural. And of course, we're not supposed to ask, well, who were they? but it's certainly referring to a plurality of beings. And this plurality was very well understood by the biblical writers. They knew the Elohim were many, and we have the names of many of the Elohim. We have the name of Asherah and Dagon and Milcom and Chemosh. In moments, we can draw parallels between those stories and the Anunnaki in the plural of the Mesopotamian stories. And so in Genesis 2, Genesis 3, Genesis 6, we have the conversations of the many Anunnaki, Enlil, Enki, Ninhursag, rolled into the conversations of the Elohim or into the internal thoughts of Yahweh, where there's been a bit of a rewrite. But the plurality of those beings is known and is regarded as a problem. So if you get into the story of the great reforms in Jeremiah and get into 1 and 2 Kings, the memory of the plural beings is being stamped out. And so the carvings of the Tseva HaShemayim have to be erased so people forget there were plural Elohim. The other Jewish priesthoods to Chemosh, Milcom, Asherah have to be disbanded and their temples destroyed and their altars broken because we can't have a plurality of Elohim anymore. We only want Yahweh. This is part of the process of monotheization. So the plurality of Elohim is acknowledged, but it's regarded as a problem. And I argue in the Eden Conspiracy that Judaism begins as a memory of paleo contact, but it gets spun as polytheism, both by the later redactions of the Bible and then by scholars of religion. We regard primitive Judaism as polytheism, and then it morphs into monotheism. So these carvings are destroyed, the bronze serpent showing what Yahweh looked like is destroyed, because the Judaic vision is being pared down to a universe with only one God, Yahweh, and everyone else is a false god. And so what was a memory of paleo contact becomes idolatry. But whatever the value language layered over the top of it, idolatry, polytheism, what is very clear is there is a memory of plural entities called Elohim, and that the Elohim plural stories parallel the Anunnaki plural stories. And even if you want to talk about the word Elohim being like a collective noun, like royalty or nobility, and explain away the plural form verbs and the single form verbs, because you've got a collective noun and no one ever quite knows what verb goes with a collective noun, that doesn't solve the problem, because a collective implies many. And the stories prove that there are many because they go to war against each other. They sit on council with one another. There is no question that Elohim is in the plural. And that really is one of the white rabbits that will lead you from a mainstream orthodox view of the Bible to the view I argue for in the Eden series.
Why are you claiming that the Bible is incorrect? We absolutely need the Bible and our faith in God to navigate this life. Why do you want to remove that support?
Hi, Jess. Thank you for your question. And I want to clarify straight away, I don't believe the Bible is incorrect at all. I believe the Bible is full of accurate information. And I believe it's one of the world's richest sources of cultural memory of paleo contact that there is. And so if you read my books in the Eden series, you'll see I always go back to the texts, in particular of the Hebrew scriptures. I go back to the text and ask, what do those words mean? Because I think the key is in how they've been translated. And so we've just been talking about the translation of the word Elohim. I did a series with Mauro Bellino where we were looking at the translation of words like Kavod and Ruach, and seeing how a root meaning of those words or the word Olam opens up a completely different view of what the ancient scribes wanted to tell us. I think the Bible is full of reliable information, but we have to translate it reliably to get the information that is really there. So I'm not in any way out to debunk the Bible. I'm out to understand it and understand it in its original form. And as I was just saying, with the loss of the memory of paleo contact, that's not just a translation question, it's a redaction question. It's a story of how the texts have evolved and changed. And the Bible itself tells that story. So if you follow the story of Ezekiel, King Hezekiah, the high priest Hilkiah, the royal scribe Shaphan, the senior priest Ezra, the boy king Josiah, if you follow those stories, the Bible itself tells you how the scribes changed Judaism from a canon of paleo contact to a monotheistic religion with one king, one temple, one high priest, and by the time we're at Ezra, one agreed canon of writings. So when I talk about the evolution of the Bible and how the stories were changed and how the meta-narrative was changed, I'm not saying something against the Bible. I'm describing the story told by the Bible itself. But that aspect of the story isn't often preached on. And I think that's the problem, that very often we equate the Bible that's been preached to us with the texts themselves. And I'm all about going back to the texts with the reformed question, have we read that right? And I think that is the gold of the Reformation tradition within Christianity. The impulse always to go back to the sources and say, have I understood that right? Have we read it right? Have we translated it right? And it's the wrong translations and the wrong assumptions that I'm deconstructing, not the Bible itself. And from escaping from Eden right through to the Eden enigma, you'll find that's what I'm doing. I'm saying, let's get a right understanding of what's in those texts, because when we get that, we realize that our ancestors gave us profound information about how the world works, profound information about what our experience on planet Earth means and how we can have a better human experience. And we miss many of these lessons if we just stick to the understanding of the Bible we've had from what's been preached to us. So that's the distinction I would make there. The Bible is an absolute treasure trove, and I wouldn't want to take that away from people at all. I want people to understand it.
Thank you for watching The Fifth Kind TV. Remember to subscribe and click on the bell for notifications so that you never miss when we upload new content. For uncensored access to our full interviews and documentaries, go to fifthkind.tv. For more videos about paleo contact and the wisdom of the world's ancestral narratives, go to the Paul Wallace channel, subscribe, and click on the bell. Thank you for watching The Fifth Kind TV.